From WXXI News, it's 1370 Connection. I'm Bob Smith, and we're continuing our series of conversations about race, about society, and about equality, inspired by the Rochester Museum and Science Center exhibit, Race, Are We So Different? This discussion today covers one area where communities within the broader Rochester community do differ, the area of wealth and economic opportunity. There is still a divide, a money divide, and a degree of difference in the level of hope and expectation of success people feel today, as we learn in a survey funded by the Rochester Area Community Foundation and reported this week by WXXI and by the Democrat and Chronicle. How do we make progress a part of everybody's life? How do we erase that divide? Well, we're going to talk about that with James Norman, the President and Chief Executive of Action for a Better Community, Rochester's anti-poverty initiative for nearly 50 years. Jim, good to have you with us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Now, why is poverty so persistent in our society today when a lot of us can remember not so many years ago, within our lifetime, there was a vow to not only declare war on it, but win that war? And we thought, at least for a while, as I was growing up, we were going to win.
Well, the war on poverty was declared in 1964. And from 1964 till about 1968 or 69, before we began to go into other things like deeply into Vietnam and so forth, we were making progress. So if you look at the poverty statistics, in 64 or 5, and compare them to the poverty statistics in 1969, during that period, poverty was reduced statistically by more than 30%. If you look at the money allocated to the war on poverty programs as they were originally conceived, the largest budget amount in any one year that those programs collectively received was $2 billion. And then the programs were broken up when the Office of Economic Opportunity was dismantled and you know, reformed as the Community Service Administration. Programs were formed out into other federal organizations. And the coordinated effort that began as the war on poverty began to dissipate.
Does Dick Nixon deserve the credit or discredit for having essentially declared a unilateral ceasefire?
Well, actually, it had to do with the, I think the guns are buttered issue, and we chose guns over butter. And so it really, around about 67, even before, you know, Johnson was gone, there was already plans underway to draw back from the effort because there was a lot of resistance that were coming from some of the local governmental bodies in some states because the money was flowing directly from the federal government to these local entities and some of the local officials weren't too happy about these communities being empowered to challenge them in terms of what they were doing.
So they were bypassing the entrenched power structure in a lot of areas.
Oh, yeah. And
they didn't like that, so they were going to fight tooth and nail then.
Yeah, like Chicago was a good example. Newark, New Jersey was a good example where you had people like Mayor Daley and others saying to the people in Washington, you got to do something about this. And so there were some amendments passed by Edith Green, and there was also another amendment that was passed to change the structure of the local governing boards of agencies like ABC that were designed to really much control them. So we have, one-third elected officials, one-third representatives of the poor, one-third private sector representatives. And in reality, that change in board structure that affects all of us who are community action agencies really has, I would say, been the saving grace because it meant that we were not in a position to be isolated from the rest of the community.
But not all communities embraced the concept with enthusiasm, and some of them probably wished that these anti-poverty initiatives would just go away, didn't they? I mean, that certainly isn't the mindset here, and I imagine if you were asked people in a lot of parts of the country where they're still struggling with it, they'd love to see more. But it hasn't happened. And I guess some communities resisted it around the country and told them to essentially go away, didn't they?
I'm from the South, so I'm not a critic of the South. I take a balanced approach to looking at race relations and poverty, North and South. But in the South, there was a lot of resistance, particularly in Mississippi. Was one of the when they started the Head Start program in Mississippi, people were very, very unhappy, and Robert Kennedy had to go down there, and Lyndon Johnson had to redouble the efforts to make sure those programs were there, even though some of the local people didn't want them there. People deserved to have the programs, and so they started and they continue.
The power structure resisted it. The beneficiaries obviously did not. Was there a racial divide even then between the people who were in power and the people who stood to be empowered?
Certainly there was, because you have this the legacy of white domination of black communities that still exists to some degree, but was very, very strong in some of those communities. And so it was not only an affront to some of those local officials to be bypassed in terms of the flow of funds, but also to interfere with their nice little calm communities where people were happy, and why should you come in and make them unhappy?
Well, let's put it this way. Their definition of people being happy might not necessarily be yours and mine, would they?
Correct. Exactly.
Or any objective observer's definition. So I guess the bottom line is it was people who felt that their fiefdoms were being challenged, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. If you look at poverty today and you look at what has happened since the welfare reform in 1996, and you look at what level of temporary assistance people are getting, and you look at it geographically speaking, the areas where people are getting the less amount of assistance are in some of those same southern states where the benefit level is somewhere under 25% of what the poverty rate is. No state has a benefit level that's over 50% of poverty. There are some states that are close to that, New York and some of the northern states being in that group.
And it may be no coincidence, interestingly enough, that those states that are the most, well, let's say, I won't say generous, but the most compassionate, are oddly enough also the states that are economically thriving with the least budgetary problems. We're not in a budget problem in New York. They no longer are in California. And these are two of the most generous states in helping out people who are down on their luck.
That's correct.
There's got to be a correlation between the two, that successful states are also more compassionate states. So that being the case, why does a state like Texas, which is now struggling economically with so many people earning essentially poverty level or below poverty wages, why are they so resistant to helping people?
I don't know. I suspect that there's a psychology that goes along with when a person is in a community that seems to be doing okay economically or maybe thriving, to have more of a sense of sharing than in a place where things are conceived to be really tight or where things seem to be on the decline, and therefore there's less of an inclination to be compassionate or considerate of folks who have less.
So these states, and I mean Texas comes to mind in this regard, some of these states are willing to accept not only extremely low benefit rates, but higher rates of uninsured people, higher death rates. They don't care. They basically don't care if poor people die, do they?
Well, I'm not sure they consciously think about it. I mean, there is a life and death consequence to some of the inequalities that exist in our communities. And so people are just making choices. And when it comes to making a choice between the status quo or reaching out to help bring people up who have been structurally excluded, oftentimes the decision is just to keep the status quo.
But let's face it, there's no such thing as a paradise. Anywhere in the country, even relatively compassionate states, relatively more generous places, and New York qualifies in that regard, still has a lot of deep, persistent poverty, want, need, and it's essentially, well, it's essentially not budging. It's still there, and it's still lasting. It's still persisting. We don't seem to be able to make a whole lot of progress on it. So, and this is especially true in urban areas, in areas of disproportionate number of people who've migrated from other parts of the country, and you know, people of color, not just African American, but Latino, and people who've come in from all over the world. What seems to be the problem? And I'm not saying, of course, that poverty isn't everywhere. It's in white suburban and rural areas as well, in much larger numbers than a lot of people want to admit, as you know, because you deal with and help out people in every part of the metro. But I'm curious to know why it is that it's so persistent. What's going on?
Well, what it suggests, if you look at things over time, it suggests that there are structural inequalities, you know, built into our society. And so you can, you know, change the time period. You can change the people who are, you know, in office or administering different programs. You can change the elected officials, but if you play the same game, then you're going to get similar results or the same results. And so what we are trying to do through the Facing Race, Embracing Equity initiative is to look at the nexus between things like race and poverty and look at some of the areas in much the same way that organizations like the Finger Lakes Health Services Agency looking into some of the contributing factors to health inequalities. We need to, take that analytical approach to some of the other areas, and that's what we plan to do over the next several months through several work groups to, in a sense, tease out the problems to a greater degree. We might say to deconstruct some of these areas so that we can more or less target more effective interventions.
How much of it is the legacy of past discrimination? That, let's face it, it's tough to overcome it in one single jump.
That's correct.
So how much of it is just the legacy of past discrimination that sometimes families will take one, two, three generations to finally get over the hump?
Well, a lot of it is the legacy of past discrimination. And when you, talk about that, people generally are resistant to that idea because it sounds like an excuse. But if we look at wealth as a factor, and we look at black wealth versus white wealth versus Hispanic or Latino wealth, you see great, great disparities. So how did that come to be? Well, some of it goes back to, say, the beginning of Social Security. So we're talking about less than 100 years ago, less than four generations ago, when certain occupational groups, you know, were excluded from Social Security for over 20 years. And so that gave, you know, groups that were in occupations that qualified at least a one-generation jump on certain groups. Then you had the Federal Housing Administration from the mid-30s until 1960 that put $120 billion into the subsidization of mortgages with less than 2% going to people of color. We know that most people's wealth, the largest representation of people is mostly in their homes. And so if someone could, you know, get a home in a nice area in 1950 and let that home appreciate, then that gave them resources to start a business or to maybe pay for their children's college or things like that. And again, you had, and until 1967 and 68 with the Fair Housing Act, that we removed all of the the racial language from our federal housing policies. So that's not that long ago.
It occurs to me there's something else that also contributes to the mix, and this may be more recent. A lot of people may not think of it, but the modern evolution of retirement savings that we've seen may be a contributor, too, because the 401k was actually a creation more than anybody else of Barber Conable when he was in Congress and a member of the Ways and Means Committee, a senior member of it. He set it up originally as another way for people to save money and save on their taxes if their jobs didn't provide a defined benefit pension. And that was certainly a good thing. It enabled a lot of people to save more affordably for retirement who couldn't have before. But you had to have a pretty good job in order to do it. So if you didn't have a decent middle income to begin with, you weren't going to create that second source of wealth. And I wonder if that maybe inadvertently contributed to some of the disparities as well, because a lot of people were just coming up the ladder, getting their high school diplomas and everything else at the time when good-paying industrial and production jobs were starting to disappear.
Yeah, you're citing, you know, that it's a multifactorial problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so that person who in the past could just go to work and, you know, be physically able to perform the work, maybe not have a high level of education, you know, could get the job for life pretty much and you know, get the defined benefit pension.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you not only have the high unemployment rate, but for some of the employment that the structurally or unemployed get, the benefits are hard to come by. That's a big issue, because we know that the biggest area of job growth, you know, is in the service sector, low-paying jobs, unfortunately.
A lot of those don't even have 401ks.
Correct.
Much less defined benefit plans. So the thing is, so that just creates, I guess, more of a disparity for people who are either late arrivals into the workforce or people who haven't been able to hook onto a good educational benefit package. It occurs to me as well that can we look at the disparity in educational funding and educational resources from community to community and point the finger at that to some degree?
I think that's, I would say if I were, you know, just focusing on education, I would not see that as the biggest issue, perhaps. I think that, and this is where I would bring in the matter of personal responsibility. I do see that we need to have more parent involvement. We need to make our schools more parent involvement friendly. We need to recognize that we now have a generation of children raising children in some cases, or grandparents raising children. So we need to have a system that recognizes and accommodates and sort of compensates for that. You know, we could use more resources, but if you look at the resources per child in our city school district versus the other districts in the county, there isn't a huge difference. But there's a difference, though, in terms of what families are able to carry to the situation because of the overall economic disparities. So if I'm working a job where I can, you know, take off 2 hours to go to the school to see my child perform in a play, that's different than if I'm working for a job, if I miss, you know, a couple of days, I'm subject to get fired. Or if I don't have discretionary funds to maybe contribute to a music class or art class, that makes a difference in terms of what the education experience is for city versus suburban kids.
In other words, are mom and dad even together, first of all? And if they are they having to take every hour of work that they're assigned just to keep a roof over their head? And are they not in the kind of job that, well, you know, if I walk out a little early today, don't care about it. It's okay. It's all good. I'm salaried.
Mm-hmm.
It makes a big difference. I can't help thinking as well, it's something that you said a moment ago about the disparity in family resources. This is nothing new. I'm thinking of how long it took every emergent generation of immigrants to a community to actually get over the hump and achieve economic parity with other people in their community. And you could look at any group, starting with the Irish immigrants of the mid-19th century, going all the way up to today, and it's the same story. First few generations really struggle before they get over. And it's just repeating itself now, and why should we be surprised when it is?
Well, I'm thinking about a statement that the former superintendent, Manny Rivera, used to repeat, that the current superintendent and other superintendents have repeated as well, is that every child can learn. And so we have to have the set of expectations and dynamics between teacher and student that makes that come alive. And, of course, culturally, our whole society is built upon myths of this concept called race, and associated with that is assumptions of ability or disability, you know, can and cannot. And I'm not sure how much that plays into the situation, but we do know that if you put high expectations out, that students will meet them. If you put low expectations out, they'll meet those. So I think that we need to raise expectations in some cases.
263-WXXI is our number, 263-9994. We're talking with James Norman, the president and chief executive of Action for a Better Community, Rochester's anti-poverty initiative for the entire metropolitan region. We have Bonnie on the air. Hi, Bonnie. You're with us. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. I want to add a couple things. One is I totally agree with the analysis of race, you know, being a major factor, both historically, which means people have to keep catching up, even when they change the rules of the game. Also, I would add that on race, the lack of still really serious anti-racism efforts within the school education system, both to educate folks, especially in urban settings, well, not only in urban settings, but in urban settings, that's still not being done, really, and that it really needs to be done so people can really be in touch with what's going on. The other thing I would add, though, is a couple of years ago I looked at a list in terms of job losses, and, you know, we all know about manufacturing, but and I didn't memorize the number totally, but the other huge loss of jobs was in the technology area, you know, computer-related jobs taken over, I should say, by technology, frame it that way. So a lot of these middle, what we kind of call middle-range jobs, clerical and other support kinds of jobs as a whole list of were at least in the millions, and it's probably much higher now. So in spite of the fact that we're going to a more technology, higher-skilled jobs, we've lost all these ones that can kind of serve as transitional things. The other thing I would say is that there's been tremendous cuts in the public sector, and the public sector is what people probably don't realize, and actually I've tried to get statistics for this myself and have trouble getting them, is that that sector over the years has hired a strong number of both women and people of color. Unfortunately, it often doesn't show up at the top of these institutions and such, but in terms of numbers, that was a place where people could also get halfway decent jobs, which also were unionized and had pensions and stuff. So that a lot of that has been kind of it all has kind of come to a head almost at the same time, or at least hit the most serious parts. So those factors are huge, and unless we start really solving those problems, and we should have been doing it, we shouldn't have let it happen in the first place. But I think it's quite serious. And on 60 Minutes the other night, they're talking about robots taking over 60% of the jobs at MIT. So, I mean, it really is quite depressing, actually. So thank you.
Well, thank you very much for calling. Are we going to end up seeing human beings en masse obsoleted, out of work?
I think she makes a good point. And she had sort of alluded to an area of decline where there's been traditionally a frontier of opportunity. And so if we, again, go back maybe just two generations when a black college graduate had a better chance of working at the post office or being a preacher or a teacher than working in corporate America, the decline that we see now, you know, in the public sector, you know, given various cutbacks, is a big negative. And as well as now the post office is, you know, on the people's radar screen as a place to be cut or whatever. And that's a place that provided a lot of opportunity and a lot of foundations for current, you know, college graduates and so forth. So when those kind of things get attacked, we sort of look at it to see what is the impact on different population groups.
It's sad to note that in general, the public sector is declining. It's essentially, I won't say completely imploding, but it certainly is stagnant, even though you could argue that the needs are as great as ever, if not greater. Look at the numbers in this area. We've had something like 10,000 jobs created each of the last 2 years in the Rochester metro area. All private sector jobs, the net creation of jobs in the public sector is less than zero.
Yes.
It's shrunk. Mm-hmm. Doesn't say the needs shrunk. There are just fewer people filling the needs now than before. And you wonder where that's going to lead us. What jobs are going to end up undone? What needs unfilled?
Well, what I worry about is, you know, that really like two worlds, the world of you know, high-tech innovation and focus on that for the highly skilled, highly educated, and the growing population of middle-skilled, low-skilled folks who are finding it difficult to connect with the labor market. And so we're going through a, you know, period of deindustrialization and offshoring of things like, you know, tax preparation and radiography, reading, stuff of that kind. And we have to figure out, you know, how we're going to take care of the people that are here, you know, in our communities, who we expect to be contributors, but we need to create the paths for them to make their contribution.
1370 Connection continuing in just a moment. We have to take a short break, but we'll continue our conversation with James Norman, President and Chief Executive of Action for a Better Community. I'm Bob Smith, back in a minute on WXXI AM 1370. WXXI Connection continues on WXXI AM 1370. I'm Bob Smith. Our conversation, Race, Are We So Different?, continues as we look at the disparity in economic opportunity in varying communities within the broader community. We're talking about all that with James Norman, the President and Chief Executive of Action for a Better Community, and we're inviting you to talk with us about it at 263-WXXI, 263-9994. We're going to get back to the phones in just a second. Just before we do, I mentioned the recent community survey done by the Rochester Area Community Foundation and reported by WXXI and the Democrat and Chronicle. They found that 63% of people in the Rochester Metro, and this is across all demographics, 63% of us think some discrimination still exists. Are they right? And if so, to what degree?
Well, there's a couple of things that I was trying to figure out about the poll results, because you're correct that almost two-thirds of the people that were polled said that if racism, inequality is an important issue, it should be dealt with, you know, in our schools, you know, in our communities, in our jobs. We should be talking about it. But then less than half of the whites that were surveyed considered it to be a significant problem. And that was a much lesser percentage than those that felt it was a problem, which would include Hispanics, would include African Americans, would include younger respondents to that. Now, they all agreed that to the extent that we have discrimination, that the group that is likely discriminated against the most are African Americans. So they sort of agree on that. But I was really encouraged by the fact that the two-thirds of the respondents that you know, first page statistic seemed to suggest that people are interested in having a conversation. And so that's part of what, you know, Face on Race, Embrace and Equity is about, is providing the opportunities for people to have those discussions.
Are we going to get, since we all are ready to have a dialogue about this, or most of us are in any event, since we want to have a dialogue about discrimination, about poverty, and about equalizing opportunity in schools and the business world and the rest, are we beginning to get that dialogue now, or are we still stuck somewhere talking about it, but not really talking about it yet?
Well, we begun to talk about it when we had what we call the launch events for the initiative 2 weeks ago. We had 200 people on the evening of the 8th. We had over 250 people on the morning of the 9th, and we had to turn some people away because we just couldn't accommodate but so many. And then there, about 150 of those people signed up to proceed to work on various areas of inequities over the next several months toward a summit that we're planning for May of this year to talk further about it. And we hope that as we go along, we'll have more people join in the discussion so that we do have the people power and the energy to continue the conversation, because we hope that this is not one of those instances where things start off with a big bang and then sort of go poof.
Because I think we all remember back in 1997, at the time of Bill Clinton's second inauguration, he called on the United States to have a major nationwide dialogue about race and about discrimination. It didn't get very far then. What's going to get it further now than it did in 1997?
Well, I think the dialogue that Clinton spoke about was derailed by his attention being devoted to ethics issues, personal issues, and it sort of lost credibility to move that conversation forward. Now that the president has been reelected, we recall the speech he made in Philadelphia, 4 years ago, and based on what he said on Monday, it seems that he feels a little more free to espouse his vision of where we need to go. So I think that from the national standpoint, the atmosphere is right. From a local standpoint, and it's imperative that we recognize the change in nature of our community, which was not only our community, but the New York and the United States community, the change in nature demographically, and that we don't wait till the last minute to try to recognize the fact that opportunity really is not equal. We don't really have a level playing field. And that because of those facts, we have a system that perpetuates inequalities. And so we have to figure out a way to change that.
263-WXXI, 263-9994. And incidentally, if you do get a busy signal, keep trying. We've got a full bank of calls right now. We're going to try to get to as many as we can as quickly as we can. Let's go right now to John on the air. Hello, John. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Bob. Hey, James. James, I got to tell you, I grew up in a low-income housing project for the early part of my youth, and my dad worked two or three jobs to get us out of there. And my mom, with four kids, also worked up at least part-time.
And your story's being repeated all over this community today.
Absolutely. And I guess my question to you is, James, is I really believe in New York State, we have the wealthiest poor in the world. If you look at some of the programs that are available, free health care, a family that doesn't get, isn't eligible for free health care, you know, you're spending $10,000 to $15,000 a year. Subsidized rents that in some of these, in some cases, you've got some pretty luxury subsidized housing projects. Food stamps, education benefits for college. I mean, if you add these up in New York State, it's a very high number. And I'm just wondering, in your statistics, between poverty levels, et cetera, are those benefits added onto the incomes?
Or should they be? I guess should they be is another question, too, because to what degree do they get you over the hump, and to what degree do they just keep you alive? And I guess that's the biggest question, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting question. There are a lot of problems with the way the federal poverty level is calculated, and there isn't a complete consideration of taxes and benefits or subsidies when that calculation is made. And there is a process that's going on at the federal level to experiment with a measure that is a more complete capture of people's incomes. But, yeah, we are one of the states that has a more generous public assistance level than some states. But if you just look at housing in the city, you find that a lot of people are spending 60% of their income on housing. And so we know that that should be somewhere in the 20-25% range. But because of the cost of housing vis-a-vis the low incomes and the cost of the housing, there isn't a lot of money left for other things that are a part of our basic necessities.
And I do thank you very much for calling in. There is no simple answer to the question, to make a long story short. We're going to try to get to as many calls as we can, starting with another gentleman named John on the line. Hello, John. You're on the air.
Hello. Bob, James, thank you for having this conversation today on the radio. James, my question has to do with changing the way we think about addressing race and inequities and disparities, and it has to do with the idea that there's one level that we talk about this at, which is at the poverty level, children, the poor, the elderly, the disabled, and most people of goodwill seem to agree that those are all things that we should be working on. I'm interested in the way we look at the long-term impact of inequity. Some of it you or Bob alluded to around economic disparities, long-term families building equity, building wealth, and the overall well-being and health of a community. So my question is this. When I came to this community 30 years or so ago, we had about, in the Latino community, about four or five Latino leaders leading nonprofit organizations in the human service sector. Today we have one, okay? And I've seen something similar play out in the private sector corporations. And so my question to you is, what does this say about the human service sector, the folks that we're relying on to lead these kind of initiatives and provide the depth of knowledge and experience to address these issues, such as you're doing with RISE and the race initiative, when in our very own community we have, at least regarding Latinos, five or so leaders in the past leading nonprofits, and we have one today, maybe two. I think the other one is part-time. So I'll leave that to you to discuss, and I'll listen on the air.
Interesting question. Thanks for asking it, John. Appreciate the call.
Sure. what you're saying through your question is that things can move forward, and just because things move forward doesn't mean that they won't also move backward. When I go to meetings of agencies like ABC throughout New York State, and when I go to national meetings where there's like hundreds of people there, I've been going to those meetings a long time, and if I take a snapshot over time at those meetings, a lot of those meetings have become more and more white, let me just say that, less and less black and brown. I think that when a lot of these organizations started back in the 60s, they were seen in some cases as an accommodation to those communities, and a lot of these jobs of like running an organization like ABC were seen as jobs that would last a while, they'd be gone away before you know it. And what I think is that as some of the organizations became more stable, that they became more attractive, more competitive, and therefore I think that's some of the reasons why you've seen a difference in the complexion of leadership overall in some of these organizations.
263-WXXI, 263-9994. We have with us right now Jane on the line. Hello, Jane. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Bob. You know, if you remember back in the 70s and late 60s, even though we had this anti-poverty goal, there was a great deal of reaction to it, and I would say organized, well-funded reaction, so that they come up with so many things. I mean, from Reagan's ketchup as a vegetable and lunch programs for children of, what was her name, Bachman, that's a moral hazard for children. And you have the social Darwinism idea that I've even heard people say, we've made a big mistake in America because we've kept these people who, I don't know how else to say, I don't remember the word they used, but people who are unworthy, we've kept them alive. So therefore, we have to now have the burden of supporting them. So, you know, saying that they're pro-social Darwinism, you make it on your own, you don't. But I was looking at some statistics, and just two things on unions. Let's see. In 1970, 27.4% were of the labor force was in unions. But in 2009, it was 12.3%. Okay, and one more statistic, and then I'm going to hang up. Unemployment rates in 1970, 4.9%. 2009, 9.3%. That will contribute a lot to poverty with all the trickle-down and outsourcing, all the structural structures that have been put in place that have contributed to poverty and have been a reaction to me against the anti-poverty programs. But anyway, that's my opinion, Bob.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for sharing it, and I appreciate the call at 263-WXXI, which gets us to one question before I take the next call, and that is, we know in the past it was possible to make a lot of progress against poverty. In the 1930s, we were a nation one-third ill-clothed, ill-fed, ill-housed, in Franklin Roosevelt's words. We've cut the poverty rate in half in the 80 years since Franklin Roosevelt started the New Deal, but we've stalled. We're still one-sixth ill-clothed, ill-fed, ill-housed, and that seems to be stubborn. What do we need to do to get us past that and rejoin the progress that other nations are making? Other nations like Canada, where the poverty rate is down in single digits and shrinking.
We need to have more of a unified commitment to addressing issues like poverty. When the Welfare reform was passed in 1996 under Bill Clinton's administration. That was a way to keep friends with people who opposed the program and those who supported the program. So what you had a mix of philosophies and ideologists coming together that resulted in the program that really its only claim can be that the number of people on public assistance has shrunk. That's the only claim that can be made from that. You can't make the claim that the people that were that denied assistance or pushed off the rolls then went to all these good jobs and became self-sufficient taxpaying citizens. A lot of them became just simply among the unemployed. Food stamp recipients, one of the consequences was a dramatic increase in people getting food stamps because that didn't have the same lifetime limit as TANF.
And some of them are dead.
And some of them are dead. So we make policies, but sometimes our policies are inadequate. And back to welfare as a case in point, is that we've never really had an effective job component connected to public assistance. We've had, you got to go make work type jobs, or you got to go around everywhere and show you made so many applications for jobs, which to the extent that some employers really get irritated by having to verify that somebody came there to look for a job. What I've found in my experience is that when people have a legitimate opportunity to improve themselves and become independent of that system to completely or to a certain degree, that 9 out of 10 or 9.5 out of 10 will take that opportunity. But if I'm going to go into a job that's paying the minimum wage, which is just a figment of what it was when it was started, and then I'm going to expose myself to not having ready access to medical care, then that's not necessarily a good choice for me. The gentleman, one of the first callers, talked about, free medicine. Well, by 2014 or thereabout, we would hope to have more people in the healthcare system, but there are some people now that don't really have insurance and aren't really, getting anything other than emergency room care, which is not the best care.
263 WXXI, 263-9994. Still got time for one or two more calls, and that one's going to be Pete next on the line. Hi, Pete, you're on the air. We got a few minutes to go.
Good afternoon. I'd like to suggest a one-hour video. Hedrick Smith, who stole the American dream. In part, he identifies Barbara Conable's 401k provision in the law as a gift to Kodak and Xerox, who are looking for a tax shelter. Second, a big part of our problem is
it was also crafted as something a lot wider. So I wouldn't say it was just a gift to corporations. It turned out to be beneficial to a lot of people.
It helped to undermine the defined benefit package.
It wasn't intended that way, but
that's what happened.
What happened is something else.
All right. To follow up even further, a lot of this stems from these obscene free trade agreements. We are being forced to compete with child prison and slave labor throughout the world. There is nothing stopping corporations from outsourcing these jobs, and in fact, they are still rewarded for doing it. They are now, this administration, the Obama administration, is in negotiations to negotiate a deal. It's called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Lori Wallach from Public Citizens Free Trade Watch has characterized this as NAFTA on steroids. So until we wake up and decide that we are going to stop forcing our fellow citizens to compete with child prison and slave labor around the world, We're going to continue watching the jobs that are created being inadequate in order for us to have a decent standard of living, unless you consider, you know, poverty a decent standard of living.
Unsustainable. That's an unsustainable economy. But it'll be interesting to see if people try it. I do thank you for calling. I'm going to try to squeeze in one more with a moment or two left. We have, I do believe, Leslie on the line. Hi, Leslie. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'll try to be brief. The question about whether or not racism exists is an interesting one. I'd like to share three very personal, quick experiences. I was on Match.com recently. I was literally chased into the parking lot by a fellow I met who seemed very reasonable and rational. Until he happened to mention, a black couple sat down near us as I was meeting him in a luncheonette, and he made a comment that I thought was a very terrible, horrible joke. He proudly announced that he was a racist, and of course, that wasn't a deal breaker, was it? And as I picked up my things and politely but ladylikely explained my views, he chased me into the parking lot screaming I should only date and maybe lesbians because no red-blooded male in America would ever be as liberal as I was.
That's an obscenity, by the way. And I think there's no way that we could possibly deal with it. Although I think the caller was well-meaning in pointing out the racism and the prejudice of others. And you know what's sad is that the people are still thinking that in a Neanderthal manner. And she was talking about somebody else, of course. So that's not something that she was thinking. But is it surprising that people are saying things like that even at this late date?
Not surprising, sad, but not surprising. And we hope that by going to the, you know, the exhibit, Race, Why We Are So Different, Are We So Different, at the Museum of Science Center between now and the end of April, that people will get some of the knowledge that they have been thirsting for that will help them understand how race is socially constructed. And how we can socially deconstruct it.
And it looks like that's necessary deconstruction this day. Our thanks to James Norman, who is the president of Action for a Better Community, for sharing this hour with us. 1370 Connection, WXXI AM and FM HD2, Rochester.